It's Saturday, November 10th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. In about a half an hour, I invite you to ask us questions and talk about technology with us. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877, and I'll give you that information again in just a little bit. First, I want to let you know that in the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe, and Ben is a web instructor and world traveler. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
So I'm actually going to be world travel a bit, which is kind of cool.
Are you really? Where are you going?
The next 2 weeks I'll be in Paris.
Wait, 2 weeks?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I thought you were just going for a couple of days.
Well, I'm going for like 12 days, but I'm missing 2 episodes.
Why would you go to Paris for a couple of days? That just seems like you wouldn't be able to adjust when you got there. And
So what are you doing in Paris?
Totally valid question.
Yeah.
We'll go on.
What are you?
No, I've been asked to MC a JavaScript conference.
I did it
a couple weeks ago in San Jose, and it went so well that they're taking me to Paris to do it again. And we're just staying a little extra time because, as Miles just said, why wouldn't you?
So how much extra time are you staying?
So the point would be I'm staying for like 10 extra days.
Okay,
but the point is that I will not be here for the next 2 weeks. So I'm going to be missing everybody, disastrously missing everybody. But that's okay. And while I'm gone, I'm hoping that Miles, at least next week, you'll be covering it. The week after that, I don't know what we're going to do. We'll figure it out. Maybe I'll host it from Paris. I don't know.
Yes, and I'm taking notes this time, so I won't make such a travesty of it that I did about a month ago.
You did great on the podcast. So
because I hit it out like 15 minutes.
Miles Elam's a software engineer and political junkie. And Miles, what a week for you. We didn't talk a lot about politics last week because, of course, one of the things we do here is not
political?
Well, in the sense, you're a political junkie. You're interested
in
politics.
Had I known about this story last week, I probably would have covered it. But then again, the story hadn't really developed yet.
Yeah, so it wasn't fully honed. So go ahead and tell us about it.
I was talking about the IT on a political scale in terms of running a campaign and the difference between how the Obama campaign and the Romney campaign has come out, that the Romney campaign is saying there were voters out there that we didn't even know existed, meaning that their ability to target and to find those individuals who may be independent or swing voters or people who are in your demographic to get them out to vote was far more effective on the left than the right. And that's something that we kind of knew already just from the election.
So you're saying that, so the presumption is that it's harder to get the conservative people.
No. The data gathering capability of the campaigns was better on the left than it was on the right.
Interesting.
But that was complicated by the fact that the GOP had a major problem with regard to getting their data together, getting their app together. They had a project called Orca, and this was a play on the term that the Obama campaign's software package, their overall data gathering mechanism, was called Narwhal, and Orca predate upon Narwhal.
We got to get more pseudo whale stuff going on in the show, I think, today.
Well, Ben, will you work on that? Apple's got the cats, right? All the different cats. And so the political campaigns, they're all different kinds of whales.
And this specifically is the digital campaign, right? Their technical infrastructure. That's what they call these things.
Right.
And I recall 4 years ago being really impressed with the way that the Democratic...
The Obama campaign had...
They did a really good job on tech 4 years ago.
And the Republicans noticed this, too. And they were working, or at least the Romney campaign was working to try to get that ground game working at the same level. And they got a program running, or they basically started writing the program or the set of programs and setting up the server infrastructure and the like just after the primaries ended, the Republican primaries.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, and this is a warning actually for the developers at large out there, it's just not enough time.
Yeah, it really isn't.
4 years isn't enough time?
No, from the time the primaries. So this was earlier in the year.
Yeah.
The only
however many months. Nothing.
7 months, give or take. And So they ran into some problems, like, for example, they tested the software, but not in real live conditions. Like the first time that it hit the internet was when it actually went live. When they had to send out credentials for password protection, they sent out the wrong pins. And yikes. Those authentication pins weren't the people behind Orca only realized the problem and came forward about it to get a resolution to it about 6 p.m. on election night, Eastern time. So, I mean, that... So, in other words...
Kind of too late.
Yeah.
So, is this an example of a really bad IT build-out?
It's a major disappointment.
What's the headline here?
The headline is the use of technology and the importance of it in order to get the vote out. In other words, mm-hmm. this is now a part of the political landscape, is this data mining, these huge databases of voters seeing how the different polling figures are going out, where you're going to need to put in more resources to get people out to vote, mm-hmm. and also where there may be more enclaves of people that, according to different statistics, would be amenable to your position or could be swayed to your position.
If you were only caught talking to them.
Right.
Now, you, I recall, Miles, signed up for multiple parties emailing and systems to get the information that they were sending. Didn't you sign? I think we even covered this on air. So you signed up for the Republican Party's message system and you got messages. Did you also do the Democratic Party?
Yes.
So what was how much email traffic? Was it honed more? Can you assess that?
Email traffic, I only ever got that from the left wing.
Yeah. Did you sign up for
it? I got calls more from the right wing.
Interesting.
And in fact, I got a lot more organized calls and more compelling ones from the right wing during the off election years. This election cycle, not so much. Hmm. And I don't know why.
Right. Maybe those people were busy with the core presidential campaign.
It's because California is not a battleground state and they're probably...
Why waste the resources?
Okay. Yeah,
the thing that I noticed about the email thing, I signed up for the Democratic email system at one point. I think I signed up for Republican as well, but I never even got anything from them, so I'm not really sure. But it was frustrating as a web developer and a programmer seeing this feed because it was highly marketed, highly tagged, targeted to me. You know, I gave them my name so they were able to communicate. They were speaking in first person, some system. But I don't believe when I get an email that's in mass, you know, millions of emails are being sent, I don't believe it's actually personal. I have a better understanding of how systems work.
So
I didn't like that hey, we're talking to you personally. I know you care about this, mm-hmm. as do I. It's like, come on, you're trying to push
me. To say personal is, I think, has a different meaning these days because I think of Amazon and the results they give, although I think their results have gotten worse over the years. They used to, I think, be spot on. But that you make a few purchases and then they make an assumption about, hey, if you're interested in these other things, you should also try these things.
Right.
And different companies do a better job than others. And they are personalized.
Yes.
But they're not, hey, we know exactly who Lyle Troxell is.
Right.
Well, we know that this person has the same buying profile.
Okay,
as
I guess
maybe the difference is in the way it's all worded, because when you get an email, it says, hi, Ben, I believe this, you believe this, let's work together to vote for fill in candidate's name. Whereas Amazon says, hey, Ben, you might like this.
Right.
Amazon is devoted to whatever, you know.
And so I also understand that Amazon has some data about me. They have my spending habits. They have mm-hmm. millions of other people's spending habits, and they can make an assessment. I know how that AI works in some level, right? So I get that, oh, that could probably be valuable to me. You know, other awesome people. Yeah, I'm an awesome person. You know, like that that metric I understand. This other one is, I signed up for your mailing list. That's pretty much all you know about me.
On the contrary. Once you know a person's name, you can then look them up on social media.
You can look doing that?
Absolutely they are doing that.
Okay. Hmm. So maybe I was targeted more because of my standing in the social media perspective.
They will look,
it's possible.
I was seeing some reports about you're looking to get information about individual... I mean... Like I said, it's not going to be, I'm going to target Miles Elam to see. It's more of an aggregate, seeing different patterns, seeing different clusters of behavior. So if your friends tend to be liberal, chances are you're liberal too. If your friends tend to be conservative, chances are you are conservative as well. That's just how our social circles work.
So to sum up, a really strong case this election cycle that putting a lot of resources into a good IT information technology system is essential for
and I believe that we're going to be seeing that as being the baseline, no longer as an outlier. This is the new way that elections are going to be run, and you're going to see a huge demand for
programmers.
Programmers to some extent, but far more so database administrators and database analysts.
Data analysts. Data analysts. People like Rick Philman, who's in the other room, is about to take your calls. I'll give it the number in a minute. I think that you're totally right, and I think that right now, there's a four-year cycle, you could probably spend some time learning to be a programmer, a database administrator in the next 4 years and or 3 years and get a really good job doing that.
And I do have to say to the listeners and America at large, I'm really proud of you, and it has nothing to do with who got elected or who didn't get elected. The turnout for this election has been phenomenal. When you look at the number of people who, a number of adults who are eligible to vote, and then look at the number who registered to vote, and then the number who actually did vote, so much better than how it's been in the past. And congratulations, America. You stepped up to your own, I don't know, best ideals.
Cool. Thank you so much. Ben, what's going on, man?
That is awesome. So I want to talk about friction, not between political parties, but actual physical friction. So, you know, maybe you go home tonight and you're like, okay, I'm going to have a glass of wine and watch some Star Trek or something like that. Maybe that's my life. I don't know. Actually, I don't drink wine. But if you reach for your wine glass and you're like me and you haven't used it for a while, you might notice that it's a little bit stickier to the bottom of the cabinet, right? You reach for it, and if it's been sitting there for a long time, it's a little bit hard to take out.
Kind
of like there's a little bit of resistance. So,
glass sitting on a shelf for a long time.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So, researchers, actually two material scientists at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, they have been looking into this and trying to figure this out because it actually has a lot of important ramifications in other aspects of the world. And we're talking, with their research, we're talking about things that are being pushed together for a very, very long time. So, we're talking about maybe using this in earthquake prediction and stuff like that, right? Because you have all of this rock that's pressing against other rock. And if you can more accurately predict the coefficient of friction between the rock, you can figure out how much pressure and maybe kind of when and maybe how much, you know? So, and a couple other things too. But here are basically the theories that they had. And then I'll tell you the new theory that they have. The theories that they had where when you squish things together, actually they're not really in contact with each other very much. Even with really smooth things like glass, they have little bumps and irregularities and imperfections in the surface, and they're called asperities.
Okay.
Asperities, and those asperities are actually the things that are touching each other. It's not the entire surface, and so we know that the more contact you have, the more friction you have. And so if you have two things pushing together for a long time, those asperities get squished together, and then you get more surface area and thereby more friction, right? So that's one of the theories. And another one of the potential causes is that when you push things together, if there's a little bit of water vapor in the air, because of this this phenomenon called capillary condensation, you get a little bit of liquid in all the tiny crevices when the two things are connected together.
Okay.
And when you get that little bit of water in there, that can actually increase the surface area of
connection. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and that little bit of water would just be exactly. Gets colder and gets hotter.
Yeah, sure. So those are the two things that we've been thinking about for a while. And they're actually proposing that perhaps these two surfaces, in the case I'm talking about, the wine glass and the cabinet, are actually becoming chemically binded together ever so slightly.
Bounded.
And or bound. Bind, binded or bound?
Bound.
Chemically, yeah, you're right. Again. Chemically bound. Mm-hmm. So, a couple of things that they figured out, like the frictional force is proportional to the logarithm of the time elapsed and things
like
that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like they put all that together, and they actually have this new theory, which seems to fit the facts a bit better.
The asperity of the the material is still going to define how much it can chemically bond, right? And the more surface area, the more chemical bonding can occur.
Sure, yeah. but it's even more than that. Well, here's basically what they're saying. If there is a little water vapor around, and they were doing these experiments with silicon, yeah. One, because it's easy for them to work with, and two, because it's very similar to the materials you find when you're looking at earthquake faults, right?
Okay.
You can use this research with microelectronics and stuff when you're manufacturing silicon chips and stuff. But here's basically what happens, they theorize, is you've got a little water vapor around. The silicon atoms at the surface of these chips react with water molecules, mm-hmm. and then they become capped, as they say, with hydroxyl. That's HO, right? So one oxygen, one hydrogen put together, and your material is capped with that. But if you bring two of these hydroxyl capped silicon atoms together, then the two hydroxyl atoms will actually bind together, spit out H2O, mm-hmm. and leaving 1O, an oxygen molecule.
Oh.
And that oxygen molecule can bridge the two silicons.
Right, yeah, because it's got a
free oxygen molecule is going to be very bindy.
Yeah.
Very, very bindy, yeah. And so if that is indeed the case...
The technical talk, yeah. Very bindy.
Very bindy. So anyway... as it turns out, this seems to explain the forces that we're observing.
Awesome.
So this may very well be our new working theory. Now, this doesn't mean that all of the other theories or causes are not there. In fact, all those other ones that I explained are probably there as well. But you put them all together and you actually can account for all of the forces. So that's kind of cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you got any small chemical/electrical things you could talk about?
Sure, I can talk about pacemakers.
Okay, I think it was a little larger, but go on.
How big are pacemakers, actually?
Good question. Big enough
they're
to make a charge.
Inside the body, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes
part of them are, and sometimes part of them aren't, right? The power supply sometimes outside the body. I don't know a lot about it, but yeah. what's the story about this one?
I don't know, a couple centimeters?
Okay.
Centimeters.
Oh, cool.
Makes sense.
Not very big.
Yeah, the power supply, though, normally has to be bigger because it's a battery or if the charger or something. I mean, there's more
Although
to it.
Although the amount of power does not have to be that much, mm-hmm. Because the pacemaker, contrary to popular belief, does not actually cause the heart
right.
to beat. It just regulates the beat. So
Doesn't it also only fire every once in a while when necessary? Isn't it kind of a detection thing that then helps?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. But go on.
It affects timing.
How is this connected to material science?
There is a phenomenon known as piezoelectricity. Piezoelectricity is movement to create electricity. So you have an item, you deform it, you flex it in some way, and that will generate a charge. So what engineers at the University of Michigan have tried to do is create a pacemaker that has a piezoelectric
diaphragm or something
on it that is reacting to the heartbeat itself.
Oh, cool.
So the heartbeat is what is charging the pacemaker that sends the tiny charge to regulate the heartbeat. So the heartbeat itself, that chemical process that causes that heartbeat, is a much stronger force than what is necessary to merely time the heart.
Right. To be clear, with piezoelectric, when you have an electric lighter, a lighter that you start with a spark, that pressure is actually a spring. You're pushing down the spring, then the spring releases and throws a mallet at a little crystal. There's a piezoelectric crystal, and that's where that spark comes from. So it's actually the compression of that crystal causes an electrical charge.
Yeah, the benzene style ones, not the flint style.
Right, lighters. Right. The ones that you, yeah. Well, I mean, they're all benzene, but the non-flint, the one that sparks.
Right, sorry, yeah.
Yeah. And also your
the ones that are like blowtorches, that's the ones you're talking about, as opposed to the ones where you're like, you snap
it's
it.
It's such an effective way to make a charge that even like electric stove or gas stoves, around this area, a lot of people have propane gas stove where you turn on the stove, and there's a clicking sound in the high setting. And it click, 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 click. What that is that's a little hammer hitting a little crystal to produce electric, even though you potentially, in the motor to hit that hammer is a motor, like an electric motor. You'd think, well, why don't you just use electricity to produce high voltage? And it's actually much more effective to do this spark thing. It lasts longer, and you don't have to have a lot of electronics. You just have to smack a piece of crystal. Mm-hmm. But go on. So that's very cool. So they're trying to make this pacemaker be powered, in effect, by the heart itself.
Right. And replacing a pacemaker is intrusive, but most of the time you're just swapping out a power source.
Yeah.
And a lot of times those can be outpatient procedures, but wouldn't it be better to just not have to deal with that?
Oh, awesome.
It also means that you don't have to have, in some cases, there's some lightly radioactive batteries in there so they can be longer lasting.
Sure.
But, you know, radioactivity inside the body.
Okay, so we've done chemical bonds and we've done pacemakers, small things inside bodies. Let's do something big.
Well, so have you ever tried to go through airport security with a pacemaker?
No.
Okay, neither have I. But it seemed like a cool segue. I want to talk about a new plane, actually. And it's not actually a new plane. It's been around for a couple years, but it's the Boeing 787. So if any of you guys are familiar with planes, this is a big plane. It kind of looks like a beluga whale. I mean, we're talking
about whales, right? Are we connecting to Miles' whale story?
We're connecting to Miles' whale story and also to my geek bit, which is yet to, to come. But anyway, this is just a quick story. United Airlines is now, well, it was the first airliner to fly this airplane in the United States. And they flew from Houston to Chicago, over 200 passengers. And
Did they build it in Houston?
No, they built it in Houston to fly it to Chicago.
Well, they have to. I mean, where did they build it? They had to fly it to get it to.
Yeah. Sure. But this is, let me rephrase. This is the first time, the first U.S. carrier to fly paying passengers.
Okay, cool.
In the 787 Dreamliner is what it's called.
So how big is this plane?
I didn't look up the exact technical specs, but it's a pretty darn big plane. If you look at the pictures, it really does kind of look like a beluga whale. So here's our technical information.
It's a lifting body design. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks kind of like an airplane. But anyway, I'm looking up.
It looks like an airplane with a little bit of rounded flatness on the bottom of the fuselage, as opposed to being just a straight cylinder.
Yeah, it kind of
like the body is actually giving some lift as well.
Are they actually doing that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Cool. And then the wings kind of curve up as well. And it's got a wingspan of almost 200 feet, and it's about 186 feet long, and it's 56 feet high. And 210 to 250 passengers. So that's pretty cool. And it flies at 0.85 times the speed of sound.
Hmm.
I almost said the speed of light, and that would have been very just patently false. I don't know. It's pretty cool. They launched the program in 2004. They started assembly 2006, and their first flight period was December 2009. And this actually, there were a lot of delays in getting it done and getting it to the U.S. So this is kind of cool, and hopefully we'll see this plane a bit more. It's also a lot more efficient. It's got super awesome materials and carbon blah blah blah, and I don't know. Anyway, really neat plane.
We're gonna do geek bits in just a second. I'm hoping you got something, Ben, because it sounds like you got something about a whale, and I'm totally fascinated by this point. And also, Miles, I'm sure has got something, and I do as well. But I want to tell you first about one of my favorite programs here on KOSP tomorrow at noon, Triumph of the Stat Geeks. Barack Obama wasn't the only victor in Tuesday's presidential election. It was also a big win for the polling analysis analysts who precisely predicted the outcome weeks or months in advance. KOSP Robert Pauly talks to two of them, Sam Wong of the Princeton Election Consortium and Drew Linzer of Votomatic, and how math nerds are putting political pundits to shame. Seventh Avenue Project is at noon on Sundays. That's tomorrow here on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. You can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook just by going to KOSP.org. You can also do geekspeak.org, of course.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah, and that was kind of in line with what, that's why I wanted to talk about it. It's in line with what we've been chatting about, the metrics and such, and it should be a great show.
Yeah,
Robert's show is wonderful. Of course, if you're not in the Central Coast area, you can also listen to 7th Avenue Project through iTunes, through podcasts. It's covered as well, just like Geekspeak. So what's your story about whales?
My story about whales, beluga whales, in fact. By the way, the plane did not really look like a beluga whale. It did kind of look like a whale, but in any case, I don't know what it is with whales these days. But there's this whale that seems to be imitating the voices of his human handlers. So I'm going to actually just play a clip of that. This is a whale in San Diego. Or maybe not. Yeah.
I love the at the end. So divers were in the water and thought they heard people talking to them?
One of the divers thought that a human had told him to get out. of the water.
Fascinating.
And so he got out of the water. He's like, wait, who told me to get out? And it was the whale.
It definitely sounds like an animal trying to emulate.
It sounds like a whale playing a kazoo, actually, to me.
It doesn't. The whales always sound like that. Awesome. Thank you.
Well, anyway, yeah. So,
interesting. We'll link that too. You can read the story as well. Thanks so much.
I would do that if I was a whale.
Thanks.
Just
man.
Mess with them.
Miles?
And just a quick geek bit for gaming. Windows 8. Here's a reason to get Windows 8. New games.
Uh-huh.
You know the mainstays of Solitaire and Minesweeper? We all know them. We've all played them. Come on. You know you've played them even when you were supposed to be working. Well, turns out they've updated them. And I won't go very much in depth. Only we'll say you can play Solitaire on the beach. And Minesweeper has an adventure mode.
Is this like a 3D game now where you control a little guy who runs around?
All right. I've got a geek bit as well. I've been pushing books lately on programming. And last week I did a whole diatribe, which lots of people have agreed and lots of people disagreed with about everyone learning to program. So I'm going to suggest a way to do so. Code School. It's a commercial enterprise. They've got some free classes, and it's basically game-centered learning to program. So it's like challenge-based. You go in and you're kind of starting a game, and what you do to do the game, for example, it's like a puzzle game, is you finish bits of code. So they teach you about arrays and functions and variables in different languages, and some of the courses are free. The Git one's fun. It kind of forces you to make a GitHub account, and during that you learn how to use Git, which is a source control system. Codeschool.com, I'll link to up at geekspeak.org as well. And of course, everything we talk about here on GeekSpeak, we make links and notes and such on the website. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight. Or no, excuse me. Online Tonight with David Lawrence. Well, it's by David Lawrence. Gets the trademark on that, and he lets us use it. We appreciate it. We can take calls and questions and comments about the technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. And that's actually Rick's expertise is data analysis, specifically in academia. So we were talking about data analysis and voting. Maybe he needs to move his field because he could probably make tons of money next election cycle just figuring out how to look at numbers.
But what an interesting life that would be. You live your life as a sine wave, you know? Like, you've got all this downtime. Oh, my God. Okay,
very
downtime,
punny.
Downtime.
Very punny. Miles, you want to cover AT&T or lawyers?
I got something even better.
Ooh.
I guess it covers lawyers. The copyright industry. 6 years ago, there was a satire post put up talking about how the copyright industry was going to put in detectors to see if you had more people in your living room when you were watching a movie, and then was going to charge you more for watching that movie. Like, it was the
holy grail, copyright.
Crazy satire. There's no way it would. Yeah, life imitates art.
Sure.
Oh no.
So yes, the copyright industry is, or the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, has lobbied for home theater regulations. And they are working, they have patented some technology to do automated head counts.
Yes. So your Kinect or your camera in the room that's connected to your TV, you can watch this movie and it only costs you $1 per person. So what you have to do is
I don't know if it's so much, but it's like if you have more than five people, it's a gathering.
It's a public viewing.
So what would keep you guys? What would keep people from either dressing up as the couch,
just wearing
or
masks,
or taking a picture of one person sitting at their living room couch and then putting it in front of the camera? Like,
oh, it's just so stupid. Like the idea of putting something in someone's home that could actually count how many people in the room and not have simple ways of defeating that, ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Unless of course it's a human being looking at it, everyone smile. I mean, it would be so.
Oh, but if you cover up the camera, the sensor, then you can't watch it at all.
Right? Oh, no, but you don't cover up the camera. You just put a picture of you sitting in front of your couch.
Or you watch by yourself an episode of Friends recording that video, right? Then you put an LCD screen of that video looping in front of the camera. There's always one person in the room enjoying themselves slightly. I mean, there's no way you can produce a system, put it in people's homes that's not defeatable. Ugh. But also,
and
on
then,
top of that,
course, there's the analog hole.
Does that mean you have the kids under a blanket and peeping out a hole with just one eye?
Yeah, whenever I speak about the analog hole with derision, that means, you know, reality.
Right,
you know,
right. The whole idea that you can't actually produce media and present it without having the ability to record it because humans can see things and cameras can too. I mean, you basically can re-record. That's the analog hole, if you will. But let's, should we start taking some calls? Why not, right? I was actually asking. What do you guys think?
Let's do it.
Really?
All right. Why not? Really? You said with...
Why not? Oh, right.
Should I say
from
no?
Seaside, Bob, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, guys. Well, people can also go to the library and check out a free video, but that's not why I called.
Oh, I don't think I don't think the copyright industry likes that very much either. But go on.
I upgraded Adobe Flash wanted to upgrade this summer, so I did. And then I couldn't get YouTube or other videos, so I had to go back and download a previous version. What's up?
Interesting. Are you on a Windows machine?
I got a PC running Windows 7 using Mozilla Thunderbird.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that kind of one-off install problem could be a myriad of things. It could be that you didn't actually get the package from Adobe. It might not have downloaded correctly. It might have messed up when it was trying to do the copy over. You could have a problem with the section of the hard drive that it was put on. So there's a whole bunch of problems that it could be. And the finding out what it actually is rarely the I think geeks rarely do, what is it when you investigate a crime scene? The forensics. We rarely do the forensics to figure out why something happened. We normally try to just solve the problem because there's so many potential problems with it. So it sounds like you're able to reverse back, and you are doing okay now?
No, I'm using a previous version of Adobe Flash. I Googled it, and there was a lot of complaints and people saying, don't upgrade until they fix it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's tricky when we get in that space of feeling like we shouldn't be upgrading, because when we don't upgrade, we open up ourselves to more problems in the long run.
Yeah. Ben? So, but you can play videos right now with your previous version of Flash, correct?
Right.
Okay, great. What I would probably recommend is wait a couple weeks and then try and update your Flash player again.
Yeah.
And if this is
Yeah.
Oh, and still no dice?
Well, thank you for the call and the suggestion. Careful about upgrading to Flash right now. It might not work on a Windows machine. The other thing to do is Google is, by the way, the new Flash update from Adobe fixes some pretty serious problems. So it's essential to get to it eventually. And right now, while you're playing in the place of being in the old machine space, make sure you don't go exploring the internet at large. And then the other thing is Chrome, Google's group, actually releases their own version of Flash, and they keep it pretty updated, and it's part of the Chrome auto-update.
Yeah.
So using Chrome as an option is a good way to go, and then maybe even disabling the old Adobe plugin that doesn't work anymore and you can't seem to upgrade in Firefox, and going over to Chrome whenever you need to do that work that's separate, that would be a little safer for you as well, in the sense that you'd use your primary Firefox browser for everything but Flash, and you'd switch browsers for Flash. Just a thought. Okay. Thank you so much for the call, Bob.
Thanks, guys.
Bye. Good feedback. It's always frustrating when you decide to do the right thing and then you get an hour and a half of pain.
No good deed goes unpunished.
That's right. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. In the air with me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. My name is Lyle Troxell. And we're talking about technology. And Ben, it's your turn.
I got a quick one. So photovoltaics, solar panels are pretty awesome. Solar panel manufacturer Amonix announced just on this last Tuesday that it has apparently broken the solar module efficiency record, and they can now do what they call a third of a sun. So they are now at 33.5% on average for their solar panels.
So what does it mean to be a third of a sun?
It means a third of the visible light spectrum that's coming from the sun. I think it's the visible light spectrum specifically. Converted into energy. So that's pretty compelling.
Yeah.
Also, solar panels, you can't get 100% efficiency. You just can't. You can't get 95% efficiency. You can get somewhere, I don't remember the exact number, so I'm hesitant to say it on the air, but somewhere between 40 and 60%, I think, is the theoretical max.
You can't
go above that. So, yeah, I don't know. 34.2 or 33.5%. Those are pretty high numbers considering. So
okay, I'm gonna take
And that solar constant that comes down. It's I'm trying to remember the exact number. It comes out to average around 1 kilowatt per square meter is the maximum you could possibly get. 1.367, I think, is the actual number.
Mm-hmm.
But then with cloud covers stuff like that, it's 1 kilowatt per square meter, but that's what we're talking about as a sun.
Yeah.
So a third of that. So a third of a kilowatt.
I'm gonna Okay, cool. Thank you for the story about solar energy. I'm going to go ahead and do a little bit. I want to mention a friend of a friend's website. James Patterson is an artist and programmer and mixes those things up. He's doing a really cool project called the Cyclic. Let's see, what is it called? The Cyclic Vacuum Cannon. And it's basically...
Oh, that sounds awesome.
It's awesome.
I have no idea what it is.
So
but.
It's a screencast about him making kind of ridiculous program, fun programming experience. And it's a creative thing. So he opens up Git and makes a new repository. He submits his source control. He's using JavaScript and I can't recall which library, one of the game libraries. He steps through using the code, talks about the code. So it's a code screencast. He also whips out Flash to do some drawings, takes those Swifts and spits them out as individual frames in PNG with a JSON that allows you to load that and use it, and then goes back to the programming language and basically is slowly building up an art project that's a programming drawing piece. And I love it because it's kind of a fun screencast to watch. I think this would be interesting for people that aren't programmers, but also for programmers.
What's that called again?
It's his website's pressuretube.com, and the project is called Cyclic Vacuum Cannon. And I linked to it on the GeekSpeak Facebook page this week. So if you follow us on Facebook, you would have seen this already.
Pressuretube.com is not it, but it's something probably
PressTube, excuse me. Well, it's going to be linked at geekspeak.org.
Yeah, geekspeak.org.
So let's go ahead and that's definitely the way to do it. Let's go ahead and start taking some calls. I think we'll talk to Chris in Santa Cruz. Welcome to GeekSpeak, Chris.
Just for Chris?
Yeah. What's up?
Yes. I just have a couple of comments, but one related to the talking whale.
Oh, good.
And the other on the thing sticking to stuff.
Okay.
On the whale one, they do have an elephant in some zoo that puts his trunk, throws it back into his mouth, and speaks several words.
Cool.
And imitates the human word pretty closely.
Oh, that is so cool.
It's fantastic. Okay, I'll have to look for it. So we'll have to look for the elephant.
Watch out for these animals. They're going to take over.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
The other thing is, on the sticking, you probably maybe have experienced a gecko walking across the ceiling upside down.
Yeah.
Gecko lizard.
Yeah, of course.
And they don't fall. They don't fall. And they think, well, why? And so they examined it, and it looks like their little feet are like pages of a book. They said, well, they're spreading the force over a great area. Then they look more closely, and the pages of the book are all serrated into tiny little spots. They said, that's it. Every few years, they know better how the gecko can do this.
Right.
And then now they've come up with, it isn't the roughness that the gecko's after.
Right. It's not grabbing onto things like a mountain climber.
Electronically.
Right.
Connected. And they
chemically.
Sort of roll their foot up, and that breaks the connection.
Not chemically.
Again. Pretty clever, huh?
Very clever. Static electricity working for the gecko. I love that it has been this, we've seen over the years, the better and better understanding of how it works to the point where we think we probably have it now. It's pretty great.
We tend to think we're the be-all, end-all of evolution, and we may be the end, but...
Talking whales, elephants, and gecko feet.
On the contrary, we are not the end. We are merely the current end of one branch.
Yeah, definitely. You think it's an end of a branch?
The current end.
Thank you so much, Chris.
All life is the current end of a branch.
Right, current end. Yeah, definitely. I was just thinking there's some great movies. What are the Chud? Is that right?
Oh, cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers.
Yeah, so we might deviate branch back out. So,
I don't know about the end of one branch, though. Like, I mean, I'm sure that there are probably some bacteria that don't evolve much or that are exactly the same that were evolved of. So
you can have species in the middle of a branch, right? So splits from that other species still exists potentially.
Or you could make the argument that
you always talk about his cousins, though. You don't talk about his grandparents. Anyway, let's go from Watsonville. Kevin, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning.
Morning.
How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
Good. I have an email question. I'm using Mozilla Thunderbird 11.0 and have had it since March, and it was going along just fine. And then recently, when I try and display on the screen or print out, like I got an American Express payment receive message, and some of the graphics show up on the monitor, and when printed out as broken links.
Uh-huh.
Yet when I open the same page in a browser, that all of it shows up.
And this is happening more than just the people that are sending the message? It's happening in other times too? I mean, than one sender?
No, yeah, it has been other senders. Sure.
Yeah. Well, so there's a couple things going on. An email client is going to be careful about external files that it downloads, and it might actually ask you, and there might be a setting for that. So I'm not really familiar with Thunderbird, but it's possible that when they send you the email, this is a very common thing, they'll send you the email and all the images in the email will actually be on their website. So the email client could, of course, go and request those images, but then potentially they would know if you got the email, right? And so that little problem of the privacy aspect of it, that the client's trying to protect you and not download remote files.
Right. This is exactly how spammers would validate an email address 10 years ago.
Right.
Is they would have an image link in there, and if the image downloaded, they would know that that particular email address that was sent to is active.
So you definitely want to make sure that that setting's not set so you can actually load the file. There's normally a button to push.
Yeah, a way that you can actually check this is send a picture to yourself in the actual email. And if that picture shows up, then it's not a picture problem. It's probably an external picture problem or pictures that are loading from another server.
Yeah, so we're basically talking there's two different ways an image can show up in your browser. One is configurable. But the other thing that's happening potentially...
photograph or something?
What's that?
Send an attachment to myself with a photograph, something like that?
Yeah, try to do it inline. There's two ways to do that, though. Yeah. Sometimes you can send that file. It's going to be an attached file. It'll be different than the inline attached. And that problem of how it displays.
Most modern clients, if you attach an image.
If you throw an image in there.
Yeah, throw a JPEG image.
Yeah, just to see if that's the problem. There's also a configuration potentially problem. Again, we come back to it. It could be your hard drive. You know, we really could have writing problems to that section. Probably not if it's so consistent.
I don't know. Miles and I are like, it could be. But it's maybe a corner case or a minority.
If you're having hard drive problems, you'd be seeing a lot more problems than
slowness.
Just your email client.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, if your main and almost exclusive problem is with the email client, then it's probably not a system problem. It probably has to do with the actual email client itself.
And I'm assuming that Thunderbird's doing the same thing that Firefox is doing, where it's doing an auto update. So it's possible that there's the update that your machine is updated to has caused a problem. You could do an uninstall and reinstall. Seems like a big step to take.
Yeah. Well, it depends which version of Thunderbird do you want.
11.0.
Okay, so you're on the quick update.
Yep.
Path.
So I guess what you guys are saying, it sounds to me like if it's not a big deal for me, I shouldn't bother with doing anything about it.
Well, I think you should go ahead and send an image. I mean, if it is a problem with your system in general, you can't receive any images. It's going to be annoying at some point.
I get images. It's just in, like I say, when they're built in with something like American.
Yeah, I'm surprised it doesn't prompt you. Usually it'll say this has external images, but then again, they may take that away just so the user isn't...
Take a look at, I think the terminology people normally use is load from external sources. That's one of the terminology.
Like that. Yeah, load external images.
The other thing you could do is, depending on who your provider is, who your mail provider is, it's very likely that you actually have a web interface to your email as well that you would log into. So let's say Cruise.io is your host.
It is Cruise.io.
Yeah, so you're probably doing POP through Thunderbird with Cruise.io. So you're downloading all your mail.
Right.
And normally the setup configuration by default leaves the mail on the server for a little while. You could go to Cruise.io's website, log into the web interface, and look at that same message. If the photos aren't there, it's definitely not your personal computer. It's the way that it's being sent or handled in that way. It's outside of your zone. Cool?
Okay.
Good luck.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the service.
Thanks, Kevin, for the call.
Best of luck.
Santa Cruz, in Santa Cruz, is Mike. And Mike, ask away, sir.
Yes, I live in a vineyard up on Vine Hill Road.
And nice. How much wine?
Getting satellite internet.
Ah, yes.
I wondered what your take was. I've talked to a provider down in Latina in person on the phone, and she had a lot of things to say. What your take on, you know, who to look for, what to look for.
Where are you right now?
In a vineyard off Vine Hill Road.
Vine Hill Road. What city is that? I'm trying to think.
If you go off, it's off Highway 17 getting toward Old San Jose Road.
Sure, sure. Okay, so what I would do if I was in the situation where I lived at a vineyard is I'd have a great time. I love vineyards. But I would be talking to got.net because... Got.net's got a lot of infrastructure on hilltop antennas, direct Wi-Fi beaming to your house. Sometimes people confuse that with satellite. It's a different service. And the reason is that that group as a company is pretty awesome. They know what they're doing. Cruise.io also might be able to help, though. I don't think they're doing any Wi-Fi direct.
Am I correct in assuming, actually, if you're on Vine Hill Road, that you're very much in a canyon? Yeah, so but the line of sight might not work out too well.
I have DirecTV that works like perfectly.
Okay, so that's a good selection
for
satellite. Yeah. Now, DirecTV probably offers internet capabilities for you.
They offer a link with AT&T that I didn't want to go with.
Why is that?
I'm not too happy with AT&T.
No one's happy with AT&T.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. So I thought I'd look online, and I saw some, you know, a lot of service providers, and I actually called one, and she had good things to say. I was wondering if there were a local person that I could talk to in person about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to recommend going to got.net. They're local.
Are they in the phone book? Is there a phone number?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's also got. It's got.net.
Yeah,
if you have internet,
he's trying to get
for a phone
access,
number.
So.
Let me get. It's the person you're going to be talking to is Don Fredrickson. He's the owner of the company. Kind of friend of mine. He's awesome. And looks like I've got a phone number. Let's get the contact information from their website. What the heck? I'm sure they've got a phone number somewhere. Oh, there we go. It's got.net is at 460-2000. So it's 831-460-2000. And I also want to recommend that you do contact Cruise.io. Cruise.io underwrites this show. They support KOSP quite a bit. And Chris Nichols Peggy and Chris started this show, this radio show. So that Cruise.io is a great company. I don't know if they offer that kind of service. I should probably ask so I'd know this answer.
Yeah, if you can get line of sight, that's going to be much faster and even possibly cheaper.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But if you can't, if you're in that canyon and you can't get a line of sight connection to another repeater, then you may be, satellite may be your only option.
And the reason why I'm giving you off to terrestrial, not is because that got.net or Cruise.io is going to be able to help you with satellite. They won't. But they'll know the answer of whether that's the one to do. Right, they'll be able to assess whether, you're going to have to go with that. And they'll probably make a recommendation for what company to use.
Great.
That's all right.
Just the connection I needed.
Cool. Thank you, Mike, for the call.
Thanks for your help.
You're listening to KOSP at 89 Central Coast Public Radio. My name is Lyle Troxell, and here with me is Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. I think that it is Miles' turn for probably another story. We'll probably have time for both of you to have a story.
Oh, cool.
Let me do one of them. Apple's got a crazy patent on curved rectangles.
Yep.
Ridiculous. It disgusts me.
U.S. patent D670,286 for a portable display device. And it basically amounts to a tablet that has rounded rectangles. That's a rounded rectangle, rounded corners.
Why wouldn't you? But tell us about something else. That's a short one.
Valve, the company that historically has done games such as Half-Life, Half-Life 2, Left 4 Dead, things like that, they have released a beta for their Steam offering, which is a game center, to run on Linux, on Ubuntu specifically.
Yeah, sweet.
And it's not that many games. Starting off, there's only 24 games. Most of them are independent games that are just generally available by other means, but they are also releasing larger Valve-specific distributed titles like Team Fortress 2 and Serious Sam 3. And they say they're going to put Portal and Left 4 Dead 2 on there soon. But this is interesting because it's the first time you've had a major game manufacturer really put effort towards Linux. You had ID Software go to Linux for the Quake series.
Yeah.
But it was like a one-off. It was one game and
a little hard to install. It wasn't like the pleasure of Steam.
Right.
I mean, also with a Steam account like Team Fortress, if I've got that account and I've been on a Windows machine or a Mac, that game is actually, I think, in both environments, I could go and log into my Ubuntu, install Steam, and download that game and start playing.
Right. And this
pretty
brings
awesome.
Up the very interesting aspect of the fact that game manufacturers went to Windows in the past because it was a very homogenous platform to work with.
Yeah.
In other words, Windows 98 had a lot of the same. A game that ran on Windows 98 would also run on Windows XP. A game that ran on Windows XP would probably run on Windows 7.
With slight changes here and there, but not a lot of development cycle.
And Linux was just such an open field that it was impossible to find.
So why are we seeing people develop games for all?
One, Linux is maturing. And also, if you target one particular distribution, like in this case, they're going for Ubuntu, and you're able to manipulate that setup to say, like, I'm going to tailor this to be a gaming system for our platform.
Right.
You end up with that same advantage that Windows had before, which is saying, we're making the platform, we're saying this is how it's going to be, and we have OpenGL now.
Yeah, okay, I see that. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, and of course, OpenGL is a big one. If you're going to be on a Macintosh environment, you're not going to be using DirectX. You're going to be using OpenGL. So if you're already doing that, the step over to Linux, especially if it's only one distribution, that's what it's always been before.
Yeah, and many consoles go to OpenGL now, too.
When you say Linux, there's hundreds of distributions of Linux. That doesn't actually help you. But if you say Ubuntu Linux, this version, then it's like, okay, well, we can do that. That's cool. That's awesome.
It only works in Ubuntu 12.04.
Steam's a great little service I use. I like it, but we won't go into that further. Ben, another story? One last story.
China has blocked Google again, and this happened yesterday. It's the first time ever since it was blocked all the way back in what was it, February or January or something?
Yeah.
And that was that whole big fiasco.
What's the reasoning?
I think it's what's going on in China.
Repressive government.
That's right. The 18th Party Congress. That's what's going on.
They're putting up a new leader. Yeah, exactly.
So they've blocked Google. They've blocked most of Google's sites. And that's unfortunately very draconian. People are wondering whether it's going to be temporary or permanent, because last time it was temporary. It was a long temporary block, but you know, whatever. But if you want, if you happen to be in China and you're listening to us, you can go to their IP addresses directly, because those are not blocked
yet. DNS entries. Got one more minute to push one really important thing. In the December 1st show of Geek Speak, we were going to be on a float in downtown Santa Cruz. We've done it two times before. We missed last year. This year, we need a volunteer to, unfortunately, not even see the float. Basically, they're asking all participants of the parade this year, in the downtown Santa Cruz parade, to have one volunteer that will handle traffic and outside the bounds. So you might not even see the parade if you volunteer, but we do need one person. Rick needs to be with us on site, if he can that day, to hold mics for questions. We'll be on the back of a pickup truck provided by, actually, the arts division at UCSC, where I actually work, the theater department, and we'll be driving along, talking on the radio. Ben and Miles, you guys want to be there for the parade show?
I would love to.
Awesome.
80% chance.
So give us an email if you want to participate and help us out, or if you want to walk behind the truck. But we do need somebody to help with trafficking for us on December 1st show.
So cool.
Geeks at geekspeak.org is our email address. www.geekspeak.org will direct you to geekspeak.org. Here's Car Talk with Click and Clack. I'm Lyle Troxell. See you in 2 weeks, 3 weeks.